playing guitar on Broadway, at the Lion King for
11 years.
11 years.
Spider-Man was my first Broadway show.
Then you did Mean Girls.
Just closed at Water for Elephants. So I was the guitar too.
You've subbed so many shows. Hamilton.
Subbing,
Lion
yeah.
Lion King. How do you sub a show?
It's only on Broadway where playing something like a Mel Bay level melody line could be really hard. You know. Yeah.
Today's episode is sponsored by Gator Cases. Guitarists, like any other musician, value the advantages of proper protection for their gear. Guitars, amps, effects, and accessories all need safe transport and storage. Luckily, Gator's got you covered.
All right. This is a very special podcast episode. I think the most amount of guests we've ever had on the show.
There you go.
We've got three guitar players.
The freelance forum.
The freelance forum. This is either going to be great or no, it's going to be great. This is kind of the Broadway theme is why we wanted to put this together, to really talk about playing guitar on Broadway. Everyone here does a ton of different things that aren't just Broadway exclusive, but everyone here also does a lot of Broadway, knows this scene better than anyone, been doing it for decades beyond everything. So this is going to be it. For all those people that are like, how do I break in? How do I get into a Broadway show? If you can't figure it out by this conversation, you're hopeless. There's no hope for you. If we can't solve your problems right now, over the next hour, it's done. Okay, really quickly, so that everybody watching at home, I don't know where I'm looking, right here. Everybody watching at home, we're going to really just tell everyone who everyone is really quickly. We're going to go around, starting with John. John, couple sentences, because people's attention spans are short on the internet. Give us the brief. Tell us, John. Tell us what's going on.
John Benthal. Have a very lateral career. Came to New York in my mid-20s. I was in Philly, rhythm section town, and came up here, got a gig in my first week with Chico Hamilton, the drummer, jazz drummer, and worked with Charles Erland. Had a band of my own for years called Code Blue. And then at one point, I got into Latin music and learned Cuban trace and a whole bunch of other Latin instruments. And then I worked with a new music group called Bangin' a Can All Stars for like 10 years, you know, as a sub for Mark Stewart, who amazing guitarist that's Paul Simon's, musical director. And then toured with Regina Bell and some other people. After doing a lot of that, at one point, I started working on Broadway because I was, looking at the stability of it, basically. And then so I've been working on Broadway for a little while now. So.
And you've been at the Lion King for
11 years.
11 years, nice. But who's counting? Okay, we're going to come back to it. Ben, tell us what's going on, Ben.
That's so awesome. I didn't know you played with Bang on the Can.
Yes, sir.
That's some
music. I'm not really a new music guy, but I was just insane enough to practice that stuff.
A lot of reading, a lot of notes. Yeah. Because Mark Stewart is a phenomenal, he's a phenomenal cellist and guitarist. Yeah.
I learned a lot from
him. And one thing, apart from everything he can do, he can certainly read. So he can handle those kinds of gigs. So you should have him on.
Let's go. Let's go. Let's call him. Yeah. Can we get him here now?
I'm Ben Butler. I'm originally from Australia. Been in the States since 1992. Went to Berklee College of Music for a couple of years. Came to New York. I've done a lot of touring with different artists, bands, singer-songwriters, Suzanne Vega, George Michael, Paula Cole, Jonathan Brook, Dar Williams, a lot of the female singer-songwriters in the 90s, and more recently Sting. I've been touring with him as kind of basically the sub for his guitar player, just kind of like how you have subs on Broadway. I'm Dominic Miller's sub with the Sting organization now. And I also started doing Broadway after a lot of that stuff. On Spider-Man was my first Broadway show back in, I think it started around 2010 with rehearsing. In 2011, I think we opened.
Did it feel chaotic or didn't?
Oh, absolutely.
So that wasn't just in the press. It felt chaotic on the inside.
Absolutely.
A little bit. Yeah.
And the contractor, Antoine Silverman, you guys would know, he would say to me frequently, "This is your first Broadway show, right?" Yes, Antoine's my first
It's not
show.
Usually like this.
This doesn't usually happen.
Yeah, there you
None
go.
Of this normally happens. Like, the stuff that happened day after day, week after week, and the whole arc of the show was, unprecedented in every way.
Yeah, because cast members were falling off things.
The falling, the money that was spent, the dramas that happened, the creative team, they certain people were pushed out of the show, and then they rewrote the show and they shut it down and they relaunched it. But a lot of people don't know that it actually went for about 3 years, and it was considered a pretty successful show. Apart from the fact that they lost $60 million.
Right.
Wow.
Apart from that, it was successful.
That broke you in, and then you did Mean Girls. And
yeah, then I did the – I did actually, Jonathan Brooke had a really nice off-Broadway show. I did her show. I did Mean Girls. I did The Last Ship with Sting. And then I took over at Beautiful Noise for Hitty, okay. When he left, and I haven't really. I mean, I'm subbing now a little bit for Sean on Moulin Rouge. He's a good friend of mine. I haven't done that much subbing along the way. I've been lucky to have shows, but now, you know, subbing is also a great solution too. If you still want some of that regular work. Sit down, play.
Pain in the ass, though.
Walk home. Oh, but yeah. The worst, it's the hardest. Subbing is the hardest.
It's the hardest thing.
It's the hardest.
Okay, we're going to
preparing for show is the hardest.
It's the hardest thing. All right, we're going to talk about. Okay, Peter, take us home. Tell us what's going on with you, and then we're going to get into it.
Sure. Well, I just closed at Water for Elephants. I was the guitar two mandolin sort of specialist at that show. That was my first show. Other than that, I had been doing a lot of subbing in town. I subbed for both of these gentlemen here, so Mean Girls and at the Lion King currently.
He's amazing.
Yeah, and I actually owe a huge gratitude to both of you. Like, I have a career in New York because of these two guys.
No way.
So
they're both saying, tell us more. Yeah. Tell us how much you owe us.
Well, there's a kickback involved.
Yeah, right, of course, yeah.
It's all right. He can stop paying. Yeah. Been long enough.
Right. but I'd say that, I mean, I remember really vividly how I got into it. It also had nothing to do with, I had no initial interest in Broadway. I had lived in New York for 7 years before I ever tried it. And I was actually on a gig for a singer-songwriter from Greece. And we were in Athens, Greece, and we were having a conversation at the bar, actually, after a show. And I just remember everybody kind of talking around the table about, like, what they're doing in the scene and on Broadway and everything. And I was the only guy there that, like, didn't have a Broadway story. And everybody kind of looked at me like, yeah.
You felt like, a little bad? Like, you felt left out a little bit?
No, kind of not initially. I just – it hadn't crossed my mind as a thing to try and do. Like, I think just, like, 7 years ago or however many years ago that was, 7 years into living in New York, I was still trying to be like an international Greek rock star kind of situation. Like that was what I had my heart kind of set on, which kind of lends itself to what I do other than the Broadway thing, which I have my own band, a music directed group called Sounds of Cyprus, which is based on promoting and preserving traditional Cypriot music, a little small island in the Eastern Mediterranean that a lot of people haven't heard of or can't find on a map and don't really know very much about. You know, it's multifaceted, multicultural, you know, music.
Okay. We're diving in. Here we go. Ben, how do you sub a show? It is the biggest pain in the ass. Oh. Everyone's done it.
Ask Peter. You subbed on more shows.
Peter, how do you do it? So when you get the call, first, what happens? Most of the time, do you get called or do you have to reach out and like network, or most of the time does someone call you and say, hey, we need a sub? Can you do it? And then you figure out what to do.
That the latter has only really happened to me, I think, once. It's mostly a lot of cold calling.
I mean, let's face it, it's not calls, right? It's
cold emailing.
Emails, messages on social media.
Yeah.
Hey.
The bar hang and all that stuff is really important too, I think, for getting to know people. But I had my most success with just a nice email and a reel demonstrating what I could do. And then I kind of came to realize more and more on how important it is actually know what's in a show. There's a lot of Broadway shows happening all the time. They're opening and closing all the time. Not every show is for every player. You know, you can be a specialist in certain things or not very good at other things. It's not really a reflection on you if you can't do well at one, but you can at another. And so I think just targeted kind of networking, or not networking, but networking in general, but targeted outreach. If you think that you both have the skill set and the availability to help a regular, which is what it really comes down to. You know, the shareholders want to be able to comfortably take a day off without a headache, so that they can do other things to advance their personal time or careers. So I think that's probably an important step that I see people missing in general, is the innate understanding of what's in a show, what's going to be required of it, what instruments do you need to know, what techniques do you need to know, and then how to just effectively communicate, like, hey, this is who I am, this is what I can do, I'm available.
So what was the first show you were on? Mean Girls or no?
No, the first one I did was Dear Evan Hansen. Came to realize, like, later on, it had a lot of things in it that I was doing for the first time. You know, unlike, for example, with, you know, Lion King with the nylon string guitar. Nylon string guitar is a thing that I was comfortable with. Or with Mean Girls, for example. I watched both of you guys' shows like way too many times, but I needed
to. Is that lame when someone like wants to watch it too many times? Does that make you nervous?
There's no too many times.
Yeah, absolutely yeah, not.
It's lame when they want to watch it twice or something, and then I got this. It's like, no, you don't.
I got this as a red flag.
It's a red flag.
I was like, oh yeah, cool. I checked it out. It's good. Yeah, cool. No problem. You know, I'm ready. Like,
no.
Because the thing is about what people maybe don't understand if you've never done Broadway before is maybe people think that, like, okay, you have to be able to read, you know, sight read. You have to be able to read. So you're going to look at the book, you know, a little, and you're going to come in and you're going to sit down and play it. I don't think that's how it is. There's maybe one or two shows occasionally where he's like, yeah, you could kind of do that. But
for
guitar players, generally speaking, you've got your setup. You've got, okay, here's two electrics, here's a steel string, here's a nylon string, maybe here's a ukulele, a mandolin, or whatever. You've got pedal setups, you know, and you've got to learn all your moves, the choreography of when to switch and everything. Exactly. And you also have to get inside, not just playing the notes, but you have to get inside, like, the attitude and the you know, even the touch. The weird thing about subbing is that it's completely front-loaded. The beginning is so stressful. And then once you really know a show, it just becomes so easy and very quickly can kind of become boring, you know, because you're playing the same show over and over, right? Like for the regulars. But the people that are playing in the rest of the band when you come in, they do the same show 8 times a week, 7 times, 6 times, whatever they do a week for years. They hear every nuance, and a different person comes in. And it's really kind of unfair, right? Because a different person comes in and they pick up your guitar and they're picking a little harder, or their feel is a little different, or they're using different picks, or they've got their acoustic guitar right up on the mic and it's too close and it's getting loud or whatever. And they don't necessarily know that, you know. And then everyone else is playing is like, what's going on over there? Or I heard a clam, and they're all like, they hear every little thing.
Is it sometimes nice when someone new comes in and brings a little different perspective, or is it always a negative? Is the point to always sound exactly like the chair?
Well, there's no way to play something that's 2.5 hours without having your own playing come through, somewhat. Right. But the main thing is you have to look at it as a objectively. You're trying to, like, get over the high bar. It's either you made the high bar or you didn't make the high bar. If your legs are hanging over, it doesn't matter if you were doing you or not, you know?
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
It doesn't have to be exactly like it, but, I mean, you start out as you really want to get the nuances of what they're doing. And then after you've been playing a bit, you can start doing your own thing once the attention is off a little bit more, and you can start, like, adding your own elements in a little bit more. But at the beginning, you try to sound as much as you can like the other guy, which is not that easy. Mainly, like, dynamics and stuff are really difficult because you can't really tell that until you're playing and someone tells you it's too loud or too soft or something like that.
What's the story? Isn't there a story that you went to Lion King one night before you took over the chair? You showed up to play guitar. And they went, okay, but the bass player is not here. Can you sub bass? Is that what happened? You went, crap.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was
Do I even know the bass part?
There was a matinee, a schedule change. And we have, first of all, world-class bass player Tom Barney, who's, you know, played with Steely Dan, Michael Jackson, you know, on and on. He's got, like, this resume. He's an incredible bass player. But there was some sort of miscommunication, and I'm a sub. I had been playing there, like, maybe a year or two or something like that. And, you know, we're sitting there and they're like, there's no bass player. And they made some calls. Once it's like 10 of or something, they made some calls and they're like, realized there's no bass player coming. So I was like, I'll play bass. You know, what the hell? Let me try. Because I know this show starts with, like, Circle of Life, and it's like bass, bum, bum, bum. And the guitar stuff is not as critical as Peter knows until maybe like 20 minutes into it or so or whatever. And so I said, all right, let me play bass. And so first of all, the crew guys had to like get out some big like clamp and like chop off the lock off his locker.
Is that really what they did?
Yeah. They give me, finally they give me the bass. Now it's like five of. And they give me the bass, and he's got like a half a dozen of these carved-in custom basses and that they gave him, and I can't get any sound out of it, you know? And finally, I'm like, you know, turning it. It turns out you have to have all the knobs up all the way to get sound for, I don't know why. But and then the next thing is, it's a five-string bass, which, you know, I play a little bit of bass, four-string bass, you know?
It's
so I'm like,
confusing,
okay, yeah. So I'll just like ignore the low string. And being a guy that I actually play a lot of different instruments with different tunings and stuff, and I sort of have this thing where even if you don't have to be a virtuoso, you just have to know when you're playing on a certain note, have a little graphic in your head of like where the other notes are relative to that note. So I think I got this, you know, and I start playing. And it was all right for a while. Tommy Igo was the drummer. I had a, you know, little clam here and there, you know, it was fine. And then we get to like the third song where there's an acoustic bass and the conductor goes, can you play the upright? And I'm like, I can't play the upright.
So you just play it on the fret?
Meanwhile, no, I was actually jumping back and forth to the guitar part and the bass. And then the keyboard player was playing some bass lines and stuff. And then we're getting into like later in the song, in the show, and there's this one song, what's called Morning Report, it's not in there anymore, but it has this really complicated bass line. It's like, you know, and I was like, I am not going to be able to play this. You know, I've never even looked at it. And then, you know, but the thing is, it's sort of like a country-ish vibe, the song was. So I went and grabbed my guitar chart, and I'm playing, dun, 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 like a root and fifth. And the drummer's like laughing his ass off. I can see him like right in front of me. And then finally we're getting up to like, you know, this song, Chow Down, where it's like heavy rock
heavy guitar. Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, what am I going to do now? You know, and then so finally, like a sub bass player comes running in and sits down
and takes it.
Yeah, and grabs the bass. But I was just like, you know, I was just like, thank God.
Oh my God.
But, you know, yeah, clams here and there and stuff because I don't really play the five string over the bass.
Wait, Ben, so you just said, so you're right now, you're like, you're subbing shows or whatever. So when you go in to sub a new show, you get the book. Do you get a conductor cam?
Yeah, you get typically these days, usually, in my experience, you usually get like a Dropbox link with the book, the conductor video, maybe audio recording. Some people cut them up into songs, so it's like an album of songs. A cast recording doesn't help you really.
Yeah.
You can listen to it, but it's not going to help you.
You won't hear any guitar on it.
You won't hear any guitar in the mix.
That's true. And the arrangements are always different, or the cuts are different.
Yeah, it's all different. And you get all that. And maybe, I know I looked at Peter's,
but he had
copious notes and additional videos of how to play certain things, which is super helpful and great. Mm. Like some things are like, you know, a weird thing, like in Spider-Man, I had a guitar tuned to. What did I have it tuned to? Nashville tuning, but it was capoed up or something.
Like
you know,
high
some,
string.
Some high strung, and it was capoed up or something. But then when you read when you read the transcription of what it is, it looks impossible to play.
Oh, yeah. Right,
but
course.
Then when you actually just okay, listen, it's I'll a make a little video. These are the chords. This is the strumming pattern. It equals this on the music, but, you know, just learn it and play it, you know. Mm-hmm. So that kind of stuff can help. So you look at all that stuff. You go and watch the show. You know, usually you want to, like, get some familiarity with it first and then come in and sit in the pit and watch the person play it. Hopefully you get it's a pit where you can actually sit kind of next to or behind or whatever. And you can not only watch them play, but also watch the choreography and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then zero in. I always ask, where do people trip up?
What
are the sub killers?
Yeah, right.
What are the money spots or the whatever you want to call it, the white knuckle moments? And it could be the easiest thing. Like you could look at something, you know, like, oh, it's got this cool part, and I learned it and I play it really great, whatever. But then when you go to do the show, that's not the thing that's going to trip you up.
Yeah.
It literally could be at this one moment in this bar, and there's a transition to this, and you've got to follow the conductor or whatever. It could. It's always the things that are exposed when only you are playing, or the things where you start the song and again exposed, or the things where there's no click and you're just following the conductor, and it's just like you, the conductor, and a singer or something. Those usually wind up being more important than some guitar solo.
And they even say, like, you know, it's only on Broadway where playing something like a Mel Bay level melody line could be really hard, you know.
Because you play on one note and it just sounds like hilariously wrong. It's just everyone knows what it should be, and you're on one fret off or whatever. And, you know, the kinds of things on gigs, if you play in bands and you've played in clubs and you've gone on tour, whatever, the kind of stuff that would just disappear the second that it happened, but not in a Broadway pit. Those are the eye-opening moments.
I would even add a little, I'm just like hyper-detailed when I would go in and watch. One thing that I would always do is record every time I go in. So if you watch it four times or even five times,
every time.
I have recording every time. So because one thing that happens is people get hung up on like the tempos within a certain specific recording they have, and then they play that when they come in. But that might not be at all what happens while they're playing, relative to the recording. So if you record like four times, or every time you come in, which could be even four or five times, depending on the difficulty of the show. Right. You get that, you get the tempo changes, but also you hear where the guitar player is, like where he's playing the ink, or where he might like ad lib a lot of spots, but in which spots does he really ad lib and which spots does he play sort of the same thing every time, even though it's an ad libby type spot, he might play the same thing every time. So you might want to do that, and then that's one little detail that I.
What were the sub killers in Water for Elephants? There had to be some good ones, right? Because that was a pretty crazy book.
Yeah, he had some tricky parts in there.
Yeah, mine. It was interesting. It actually lends us to what John was saying about the tempo thing. We had this one big number towards the end of the show that was all underscoring, but the acting dialogue was not timed to the music. So it was a lot of push and pull, and it was just guitar doing this simple chord thing. And then eventually, violin.
Was it like a gypsy?
No,
was that a different spot?
That was a different. Yeah, the gypsy thing was. That was a fun one. That one wasn't necessarily a killer because there was a lot of people playing at the same time, but apparently it was hard to do at tempo. So, but this one was like, it was slow. And that was one of the things where I kind of, everybody has techniques that they're comfortable with and, or that they've never done before. And this was a thing that I was doing that all my subs kind of told me they had never tried, but I was muting three of the strings with the palm, and I was striking the third string with the thumb and then strumming with the middle finger up and down like this, because the ink was basically just G's and D's with the stem for the G down and the D's up. So I wanted to ring it out, and I was trying to do the ink as much as possible. And I had a lot of guys come in and they were holding the full G chord, and that was one of those things that they're hearing every night. So they're like, oh, we're hearing like lower than normal kind of things.
Like when your subs would come in.
They don't necessarily know what's different.
Right.
But they'll say, oh, yeah, it wasn't. On that number, that it wasn't quite right, and then you're the regular player, right? And you're going, well, what should I tell them? And it's like, well, it just didn't sound the same. Just
tell them it wasn't. Yeah, right. Right. Just tell them it wasn't awesome.
It doesn't sound the same. It's a different
exactly.
Thing,
So. Zach, I would say, in some ways, this conversation we're starting at the end, because when you have somebody like Ben, who's an A-list player, he could walk into a Broadway show and he has a reputation. And they're like, okay, we're going to like throw you in here. And, on guitar, and especially like drums, I have people like asking me like, oh, can I sub on this show, and talk to your guy? And it's like, well, if you haven't done it before, there's no way in the world you're going to walk in there, having played at the Bitter End or something, and then like walk into a Broadway show and like play
and know
that.
What to do.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's actually really important to start small, like you'd have to start like doing some college productions if you're, if you're in school or whatever, or even not, like just do that. I mean, I always kind of did that just as entertainment. I thought it was kind of interesting just to do these gigs that involved reading and stuff like that, even though what I was doing was more like playing jazz and different stuff, you know.
You always met the girls, though, when you would play in a musical in college. That was always a good tip.
In my experience.
There's
not
that.
The jazz
yeah, right.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So you and at Berkeley, that meant something. Yeah, right. A lot yeah, of dudes
exactly.
Around.
Right, yeah, yeah. Right. Not jazz club, not so much. Yeah. But anyway, you know, so you'd start out with like a college production or regional productions, and you really have to kind of get some experience of working with a conductor and stuff like that, and just the whole vibe. And then there's the whole, you know, so you develop that over time. And then there's the whole like Tommy Tedesco, you know, how to walk in and, you know, like get along with the people and show up early and like, you know, look at the charts in advance and, you know, that all kind of, that whole thing. As far as playing on Broadway, people always say, well, you got to be a good reader, right? It's like, well, yes, but you're not you have to be a good reader when they're, if they throw the music at you, like when you start a show, which I've done like maybe like 8 or 9 shows that were my own shows. And then you go in and you rehearse, they rehearse the actors for like 8 weeks. And then you go in and they get the band in like 2.5 days.
Yeah,
you have.
Right.
So yeah, you're definitely.
And they go, here's your book. And
yeah. Yeah. But I always feel like if you're subbing, you just have to be a good preparer. You don't necessarily.
Yeah, that's what I was getting to.
Be a great reader. Yeah.
Right. You don't need, you're not reading at all by the time you go in a month later.
You've already memorized it.
Yeah,
You're looking at the music because you have to know where
reference
you are at all times
it, yeah.
And you have to follow a conductor, look at the music, but you're not.
I think that's
you're
part
not sight
of,
reading anymore.
I think that's part of what is the big sub killer moments as well, too, is those things that really should be memorized that you don't really realize need to be memorized until you're there and tempos are changing or, you know, things are happening with actors and you realize, oh, this is based on a cue and, you know, so.
Yeah, you're glued to the conductor.
Yeah, you need to be glued to the conductor on so
I mean, that's
things.
Something that when I did the very first thing I did is actually subbed on Spring Awakening for Tad DeBrock.
Oh, right.
And full confession, I tanked. And I
why? What do you mean? You just didn't know the part, or
no?
What
I knew it really. I knew it. I they didn't know how great I was.
Okay.
No, I knew the book. I knew the parts, and I could play them. And I was even told, you know, that's how we want. Like I could play Duncan Sheik's guitar parts. You know, I would say pretty authentically to how he wrote them and how they were in the show. Right, that wasn't a problem. What I didn't realize is I completely underestimated. What is probably was the biggest gig really was following the conductor. And I had never really done I'd barely done anything following a conductor, not what you're talking about, regional theater or even high school, you know, band with, I mean, it just, I hadn't really had experience doing it. And I thought, well, I know the stuff and, you know, I was approaching it more like a band musician, like a rock band musician or a band on tour kind of thing. And also back then they weren't really doing conductor videos, like distributing conductor videos, or if there was, and in fact, Tad even told me, he said, you know, some people bring in a video camera and film the conductor. I'm like, oh.
Why would I do that?
Why would I do that?
Yeah, right. Well, I found out why, because I was not good at following the conductor and when she was bringing me in and stuff like that. And we had there was one moment in the show, I still remember it, but I followed her wrong and I came in wrong and the cellist was playing and I'm playing and we're in two different places. And I tried to kind of like iron it out just like as again, like I'm saying, like in a band, you know what I mean? I'm playing and I'm looking over and whatever. And I wasn't looking in the conductor. And I think that was the last straw. And she was
right.
And the funny thing is Kim Grigsby, we became friends and she was the conductor on Spider-Man. So by the time I came and did Spider-Man, plus we were opening a new show and plus I basically learned on the job how to follow her. And
yeah, I was going to say, how do you learn how to do it if you don't know how to do it?
Exactly.
And if you can't get the gig, you just have to.
How do you learn how to do
it?
I mean, well, what I should, in
it.
Hindsight, what I should have done is, first of all, I should have watched many more times. I should have taken the advice and got a video camera and filmed it. And I didn't know. It's that classic thing. You don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
You know what
right,
I mean?
Yeah.
So I didn't know that was going to be the thing. If I could see the future, I would have realized that's what I need to focus on. But I learned the hard way and it all worked out in the end. But I should have focused on, and that actually helped me later on to realize like you should be looking for the things that don't gloss over anything. Look for the things that you go, yeah, that actually might be a little bit tricky for me. you know, like, because I think your ego can get in the way if you think you're a good player or whatever. You could be like,
I got this.
I got this. Exactly. Yeah. When anyone says, I got this. You say, I got this. It's like, hold on a minute. Do you got this? Like, let's go back. Let's look. Are there things in here that maybe you're assuming that you have? And look at it again and just.
Yeah. I mean, Broadway conducting is pretty straight ahead. Mostly it's like right on the downbeat, whereas an orchestral thing, I do work with the New York Philharmonic when they need guitar and stuff. So that's a whole different thing. Oh, the beat will be here. And then when their arm is way up here, you know, that's when you initiate the note. And it also depends on like who's playing at the time. Even in a Broadway orchestra, if it's like strings, they're going to be behind. If you're playing with the strings, they're going to be behind the beat a little bit. Yeah. And then if it's like woodwinds and stuff, it's like, you know, so you kind of have to like dial into exactly what's happening with the, you know, following the conductor and everything. And there was another thing that Ben said that, you know, that I agree with about as far as like when you're subbing, the choreography of like, you know, like watching what the guy does and everything. I mean, one thing I always did is I set up what I would call like a cockpit that was like an exact replica of what was like the guy had it set up. And then if I had a video, I'd have like my laptop sitting right there where the video monitor would be right in front of me.
Yeah.
And I'd play it like a million times. And also I'd always make sure I totally knew it by like a week before at least. Mm-hmm. And then just running the whole thing every day after that. But as far as like the cockpit stuff, you know, you get all your moves, you have like, one thing is that also I would time like how much I would write on my charts, like how much time was between the songs people would get to the end of the song and they would panic that there's like the next song is coming where it's really 2 minutes away.
So well, I look well, at the opposite. That take too much time. Right. Let me get to the nylon. Oh, shit.
Yeah. I'd look at the thing. And so all my movements would be like totally smooth. I'm picking up the mandolin and I have this much time. Whereas I'd see, you know, as a regular guy, I'd see like guys like subbing on bass, like stuff like that, and that were didn't prepare that way at all. And they'd be like throwing charts all over the place.
Stuff like that.
When you started Elephants, and so you go into, you basically get to design your cockpit and you get to make it as easy or difficult to use as you want. Like, how much say did you have in figuring out what your space was going to look like? How to make it easy for subs to come in.
I think the only thing I got to really say about was which direction my chair was facing. You know, by the time I got into the pit, they had built these, it was an all acoustic show. So they had built these big blocks for soundproofing. And they had me facing one way. And I thought this is just with, you know, five instruments is not going to work. So I turned my chair one way or a different way. And it was kind of like there was a hallway.
They yelled at you for that, right?
But it, you know, it was like you can't touch anything, you know, because that's like a union thing too.
You can't move.
Right. Yeah. So I wanted to turn my chair.
You don't have much space, so it's a matter of.
So you turned the chair. And then was there anything – how much of the book was your – were you able to put your personality, your playing into it? Because I feel like on that book, weren't there moments – where stuff was like little vague.
That's a good question.
And you were able to.
I think the whole book was my personality.
Really?
And I think that's why they got me. And I think that's probably why any show gets any person. I mean, orchestrators really know a lot of things, but they only know so much as that they know, you know, and then they really rely, or the creative team, you know, the directors and supervisors and orchestrators and composers, they really rely on bringing in people that are going to take their work across the finish line. So, you know, I was brought in literally because of the mandolin thing being such a heavy part of that show.
Didn't you get this gig because didn't you play mandolin with someone once like years ago?
And
they remembered it.
It's kind of funny how it happened. No, it was, I was subbing out on the Mean Girls tour, just for 1 week for the regular that was, taking some time off, and the, conductor for the show, who was the music supervisor for Elephants, was really concerned about the mandolin. And he would ask me, I was like, it's going to be okay. I got it, right? You know, but I went out and I was doing some warm-ups on the mandolin and he was looking at me, and then I played the show and all was good and everything. And we went out afterwards for tacos after the show, and he had finally, I think, checked out my Instagram. He was like, oh, so you're really like an oud, lute, acoustic playing person, and you play guitar. And I had a laugh. I was like, you know, it's funny because I watched your show 5 times and that was one of the more difficult ones. Ben was the chair for it here on Broadway. So I just remember how much work I had to spend on the electric guitar stuff. going back to the cast album thing that you mentioned too. But yeah, so I just, it was funny because when we were talking about
that,
it
was the easy part, the man.
I mean, yeah, and I said that to the MD there. I said, out of all the things you had to worry about, that was nothing.
Yeah. You know?
But the you remind me though about the cast album situation. I remember when I was watching the show, Ben was doing these really crazy, like, solo things, and it was such a non-consequential moment in the show, turns out, because I remember saying to you, I was like, if this is the expectation, I need like another 100 years to practice. Like, I don't think I could ever do any of these, like, you know. So, and then you just it was crazy shredding, and you told me to listen to the cast album, and I had another good laugh because I was like, were you even there that day?
Like, yeah, right.
Like, well, like, when they mix
let
the
me just put this out there. Most guitar players, you never listen to a cast album. Like, yeah. I've listened to maybe like the first 10 seconds of every track on the first show that I did. Mm. And that's about as far as I got. Because it was like, you're like, okay, 90% vocals. You don't really hear anything that I did, more or less. You know, some of it.
Yeah. And the other thing you should never do, I recommend do not do, is take off the show so that you can sit in the audience and watch your own show. Because that's why, you know, crushing. Rookie move, you know, like
on Spider-Man. Because you realize, oh, I'm not even in a herd in the house. I'm playing all this great shit and nobody can even hear it. Is that why it's crushing?
Yeah. I mean, I was like on Spider-Man, which was in previews for, I think, almost three and a half months or something. No show was ever in previews that long.
Yeah.
Because while I was in previews, they still hadn't finished it. So, you know, they would, anyway, it was a total mess, right? But they eventually allowed us to sub out during previews because, like, this is ridiculous. Like, you guys have been here all through the rehearsals and all through the previews.
Yeah, right.
Eight shows
a week. Typically, you can't sub out during previews.
Typically, you can't sub out until a week after the opening night. And let's all thank Local 802 for the contract that is a Broadway musician contract because it's pretty damn good because you can sub out up to 50% of your shows. You can take a leave of absence. You know, there's health care and pension and the scale that you get paid, you know. But anyway, so they let us sub out. And my very first show was sub. Actually, it was Sean Driscoll, I think, was subbing for me. So and Sean was great. He learned the book or whatever. So I was like, finally, I'm going to get to see what this show sounds like. Because don't forget, we're all in there. We've got headphones on. We've got an Avion. We've made our own mix. I've got, you know, everyone's always like, I've got lots of me, okay? You know, I've got click, I've got drums, I've got
vocals.
Lots of me. I've got,
you got a little vocals.
Some people have like
you have
vocals,
to hear but, a
you know,
touch.
Yeah, yeah, I've got vocals. I've got a nice, you know, spread of keys and everything else. And, you know, but it's very much a me-centered mix and bass and drums, like a rock band kind of thing, you know. And that's not, no one else has that mix. Only I had that mix. And then you go out in the audience, you realize, though, okay, this is a Broadway show. People are telling stories. They're singing. They're communicating the whole drama of the thing. And the person is mixing it. They have, generally speaking, I don't want to speak out of turn. They have a music mix. Then the music mix is subbed down to a single fader, right? And then they have all these faders, which are individual actors, because they've all got their radio mics, the little mics on, and they've got lines, and they've got a mute in between, and they've got to push people up for certain lines, everything. So the whole music mixes on this one fader, and then all the actors, you know. And so if you think that's going to sound like a U2 concert.
How do you deal with, like, the hardest thing when I've gone to sub is, like, you go in, you learn the book, you do all the prep you can do, that's expected, and then you sit down, there's a volume pedal on the pedal board, and you go, I don't know what the reference is for this volume pedal.
Yeah,
how do you deal with that? Like, that's the hardest thing.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, in the regular player, in my books, I have it marked that the volume pedal is like half, where the guitar, you know, knob is on like volumes on seven or eight.
Or whatever, yeah.
So you break it down so it gets like pretty close, you know. And then the other thing is I do is I don't give too much headroom in terms of volume that's available. You know, the loudest that I'm going to play is going to be like maxed out on my thing because you want to have a sub playing twice as loud as you or something like that.
Right.
But it should be pointed out that like each musician has a little mixer like beneath your music stand that you blend. He was talking about his mix. I do the same thing.
Yeah.
I have guitar, bass, and drums. And then everybody else is like that big so I can just hear, you know, you get used to it. You hear exactly who's playing what. That you have to line up with, but mainly you're going to play like a rhythm section, like guitar, bass, and drums, you know, just to lock in, you know, but everybody has their little mixer that you can adjust the, the balance and the level of each instrument that you're listening to, or sections of instruments.
Which can be a problem, because when a sub comes in, they might go, oh, you know, I don't like hearing myself as loud as Ben does, so I'm going to turn myself down a little bit. But then consequently, they may be hitting the volume pedal and they're hitting the strings harder because they don't feel like they're that loud. So they're digging in more, and then it's like, well, you're too loud.
So is the best advice to leave the headphone mix exactly as is?
If you can stand it.
What do you think?
I think it's a really excellent spot to start. Like, you have to live in the regular's world to understand why it got that way first.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you think you're fixing one problem and then you create another four or five along the way.
Yeah,
you know.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a little different when you're there as a regular, because I might be louder, but I don't really hear it that way. You know, I'm listening to the other instruments. I'm not really listening to myself, but right. I have my level up kind of high because I don't want to start like hammering away on the guitar. And so I want to have the right touch. So, you know, as a sub comes in, it's like, whoa, the guitar is really loud. You know, so that's the reason. It's not that you think you're the most important thing in the play lighter.
Yeah.
How much prep did you do to go in for Dominic? Did you start off subbing for him with Sting? Or when you got that call, what did you have to reference to learn?
It was a gradual process initially, because I was playing with Chris Bode, the trumpet player that played with Chris with Sting for a long time. They're very good friends, and I was playing with Chris Bode band, and they put together a little tour, and it was Chris Bode with Sting as the guest vocalist and his percussionist and background singer. So we got to kind of do like a 50-50 show, like half of Chris's stuff, and then Sting would come on stage and we do a whole set of Sting's songs. So that was kind of like a practice run at like being his guitar player.
And then your show, right? You had
the, and the show, but that was show. that was a Broadway show. It was very different, you know, two guitars and a lot of acoustic stuff and a different kind of
which
music.
Which was last ship of the Sting.
Yeah. But it was definitely, you know, another aspect of working with him. But then I think I did one of the Symphonicity shows, which is with orchestra.
Yep.
But once that started, and then they started calling me to sub on, and then I ended up doing the tour in 2019 with Dominic, had heart surgery and fully recovered from. Then my preparation for that, I think I've a few different times I've gotten like a board mix, like, you know, I've contacted them, so can you at least send me like a recent show? And I've got some right now. I'm about to do a show with them next week.
Where?
In Miami.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I'll have a board mix, but honestly, YouTube is like so crucial to me now, because I will go on, I'll search, you know, by upload date Sting shows, and I'll see, oh, someone, because you never know
who's
going
to. There's always someone.
There's always someone who's recorded, like sometimes a pretty good version of a whole entire show, you know. And so I can keep up with where things are at, you know, because he'll add songs to this. I've also setlist.fm. You can go and you can search an artist's set list.
Right. So you go and you look at everything.
And you go, okay, last week, oh no, he started doing this song again, which he hasn't played for 10 years, you know. So there's another one to learn.
What's the secret to playing Message in a Bottle? Isn't it hard? Even though everyone learns that riff when they're a kid, I feel like to play it for the whole song and to make it sound consistent and great is like really hard, isn't it? Like,
it's hard.
You just do that for hours and hours?
The other one that's hard is Every Breath You Take. To play it, it's the consistency. Dominic Miller is a fantastic player.
Amazing.
He's so consistent. His time is impeccable. His touch, you know, but also he's been doing that gig for like 35 years, right?
Yeah.
Which is another interesting thing, because you can go and look at older versions of songs, and Sting loves to change things up. He'll even change things up tomorrow. He'll go to sound check and I wanted to do something different in the bridge on this song. It's like, what do you mean? You've been playing. It's 40 years later. You want to change the bridge, you know, or in sound check. He's always early. He's on the stage. You get to sound check. He's already on the stage, bass plugged in. Hi guys, how's it going? And then he'll start playing one of his songs that, like, hopefully you know. Yeah. You know what I mean?
What chorus pedal do you use on that gig?
The Boss Stereo. It's the CE3. From the 80s.
Yeah.
It's sort of a sparkling blue analog in stereo. And there's two modes. There's one wide stereo mode, that gives it, it's like the, you know, the JC120 amps where one speaker has the chorus and the other is got no chorus, right?
Yeah.
So it's like dry on one side and then pitch modulated on the other side, and it makes it sound really wide. And that's kind of on most of the time. And then there's, then I just picked up this, the Electric Mistress, the EHS Electric Mistress sort of chorus flange sound is really great on Walking on the Moon and some of those big splat, you know, chords that just go
amazing. Yeah, right.
And there's a company out of Australia called Past Effects that makes a really nice clone of that. On my board right now, I have this the Hartman flange, which is like a large box clone of the EHX. Because the Electric Mist, I've never owned the original. Maybe I should just buy the original. But but I've heard that they're really bright sounding, and there's a big level difference when you turn them on, and they can be problematic. But that's and also the other part of that sound is the compressor pedal. It's really crucial, and the Boss compressor. I think it's the CS2 again from the 80s. It just has that sound. I mean, I think Andy used the Dynacomp. But he also had a preamp in his guitar or something. But
that is the sound, though, is that compression.
But that compression that just, like, chord just goes like this. It's really wide, you know.
What's the rig look like at Lion King? Has it ever been updated to, like, did you ever update it to anything digital? Or is it still the original rig
from the 90s?
No, it's
really, really, really simple.
Yeah. What is it?
I just have, like, a carbon copy delay. And
really?
Like a chorus pedal. I basically, you know, used the same thing that the other guy had, but I upgraded the sound of everything. And then there's a J Rocket. It's called a 10-ton hammer. That's my heavy overdrive, which I use for a lot of like sound effects and stuff like that. And then just the
Blues Driver.
Blues Driver, yeah,
like the Boss
Keeley modded one.
Keeley modded,
you know, Blues and it Driver. Actually that's a lot of my like solo stuff and lines and stuff like that is on that.
And is it a real amp or what are you?
And then I have another J Rocket Icon that's just sort of on. No, I use that as a boost to just like, you know, fatten up the sound a little bit. That's it. There's just like a couple of pedals.
What do you play into though? Is there a head or like a?
I was playing into a little like Blues Junior type thing or whatever it was, and then I switched over to one of those Milkman amps. That's just like
I still use the
speaker from the amp, you know, as a monitor in case like stuff goes out.
Cool.
You know, I could still hear it a little bit in case like. Something goes haywire.
But you keep it pretty low.
It's really low. And it's actually a really simple setup. But I use a lot of, whammy bar and do a lot of like scary sounds and stuff like that, you know.
What was that? Didn't you buy like a mandolin or didn't you buy something for Wire for Elephants that you were like, I need the perfect mandolin sound? Didn't you get an instrument for it?
I got a new Americana style vintage 1930s Stradolin mandolin for the show. Mainly because when we were first talking about the show, they were really big on bluegrass, and that's cool. Like, there's a lot of F style and A style bluegrass mandolins. But then I came to realize as the music was being thrown at us every day, that's only like one or two songs. Like, the rest is a lot of singer songwriter kind of, style music. The show also took place between like the 1920s and 1930s Depression era through when the guy's telling the story. So I thought as well it would be really cool, like if I'm going to get like
period correct
sound, like it would be cool. I mean, I did upgrade the tuning pegs to get the, you know, those 15 to 1 on those 1930s ones, really wonky sounding, never really well in tune. So I changed those out for or the 12 to 1s, right? I upgraded them to the 18 to 1s. But I thought that was a good move. I mean, I have a lot of mandolins, but it was a good excuse to get a new one.
I have a banjo from like the 1920s. That's awesome. And I need to upgrade the tuning pegs. I've been to do that for years.
Yeah, Stumac.
I got to go on Stumac.
Waverly. Now they're expensive.
Okay, we're wrapping up here. Okay, what is the best part across all of your gigs that you guys have played in your career? Broadway shows, Sting, Chris Botti, everything. Is there a guitar part that stands out as like one of the most fun, the most interesting, or really cool lick, something?
That's a tricky question.
Even something iconic, like even getting to play Every Breath you Take every night. I don't know if that means anything to you. If
absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe that's it.
I mean, you just mentioned Message in a Bottle. It's so fun to play that song.
Yeah.
And we usually start with that song. And it's just a rocker out of the gate. And it's got the great riff and then the chorus, you know. It's a good one.
That one's
there's a lot of good guitar parts in it.
Because you've been playing that song your whole life, right? And then you get on stage
but
and play.
The interesting thing is, if you play that riff without the harmony part, you know there's a harmony part on it buried in the mix. You go on YouTube and look at.
Like a harmony guitar part?
Yes.
And do you play both at the same time?
No.
How do you do it?
He's tried different things, like starting out playing the riff with, and then the second verse jumping up to the harmony part and then going back down to the main part. But I can't remember if it was Rick Beato or somebody did a whole thing on Message in a Bottle. I'm sure a lot of people have. But when you check it out or you can find the isolated guitar part on YouTube and you listen to it, like, damn it, there is it's like a third up, but then some intervals are not a third. And you realize, yeah, when you take that away, it doesn't
matter. So what do you do live?
Well, like I said, start out on the riff in the regular.
And then you have played
And then I think it's like after 8 bars, go up to the harmony and then go back down to it. Just so it's still in there for some of the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And then actually a sting has started to play the riff on the bass sometimes as well.
Oh, man.
Because on the record it's doom, doom.
Yes,
doom,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Doom, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a good one. I like that one.
That's good. What do you think?
Well, let's see. I don't know about specific guitar parts, but I would say, some of my touring things, when I was doing a world tour with this singer, Idina Menzel, there were some high points were playing at Wembley Arena and Budokan in Japan and stuff that. I mean, that was like
Cheap Trick
seriously
at Budokan, right?
Fun. I mean, that was seriously fun as far as guitar stuff, some of the things that I mentioned, like the modern classical music, like the bang in a can stuff, was so insanely hard that I did, there's not a specific part, but I mean, I did feel a real sense of accomplishment being able to pull that off, you know?
Yes, mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. that was that. It's, not so much specific guitar parts.
Could you remember any of that stuff now if you picked up your guitar?
No. But, what was insane is that, I had, this pile of music that was, a foot and a half high.
Oh, my God.
And, from charts that I had from them. And at one point, I don't know why, but I just, tossed it all out. I was like, I don't need this stuff anymore. And I threw it away. And I was talking to some percussionist about, these really cool pieces.
Yeah, yeah.
They're like, oh, man, let me look at that. I was like, oh, I threw it away. He was like, what are you, insane?
That's how you get the gig, though. You throw out the music, that's when people call.
That's exactly what.
Yeah. You show those charts.
Oh, my God. That happened to me. I had a pedal steel that sat in my closet. I went through a phase where I was playing pedal steel for a long time. I got pretty decent at it. Then it sat in my closet for years. And I was like, you know what? I want this other piece of gear. I'm going to sell the thing. I think within 2 months of selling that thing, I finally got a call for a gig.
Yeah.
I was like, I can't do it. I'm sorry. What do you think? Anything stand out? You've subbed so many shows. Hamilton.
Subbing,
Lion
yeah.
Lion King.
I think, though, a career highlight kind of thing for me was being able to take Sounds of Cyprus to Cyprus on a sponsored trip.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, I mean,
that's so great.
Because, you're trying to do a thing as, a Greek Cypriot American, and you're here and you're playing for community, whatever. But to get, an invitation from the government to do, a tour of shows. And then, that being validated when you play and people start dancing, I'm doing the real thing, for them, and they're digging it. That was for
Dude,
me was
awesome.
Peak.
Yeah. I love awesome. It. Who's got the craziest guitar collection? You've got some weird stuff,
you
right?
Probably do.
Oh, yeah.
You've got
a lot of stuff.
I was on your Instagram. You highlight a lot of it. I mean, you've got some cool stuff.
Yeah, I mean, just every fretted instrument. I mean, I have a lot of. I did a long period playing Cuban Trace, that's a favorite, but as far as I don't know if I have really weird stuff. I mean, one of the weirder things I got was a Indian Sarode, which I was like, man, I love the sound of Sarode. Let me get one of those. So I got one and realized I can't play it at all because you have to have square fingernails.
You have to play with your nail, right?
Yeah, it has to be a hard, square, flat fingernail. And then you play it like this. It's like the opposite of slide guitar.
Yeah.
The neck is metal. And then you're sliding the strings on the strings with that. And you can't be a guitar player and have those nails or do anything. So, I made some finger picks that bent over my fingertips that I could play it a little bit. But there's no way you could you know, you'd be like punching like every three notes or something like that.
Oh, you know? Didn't Derek Trucks study this road a little bit? There's a Middle Eastern Institute or something. In
oh, really? Yeah, that makes sense.
That makes sense with his.
Because he does a lot of those like type of
inflections. Yeah.
But, oh my God, you've got some weird stuff too, right?
Mine is mostly in the Eastern world too. Lauto, Oud, Jura, Buzuki, Baglama, Saz, that kind of world.
Yeah. Okay, to wrap it up, some kid in college is going to be listening to this and trying to figure out how to break into the scene. Are you guys accessible if they reach out, or should they not even bother because, you know, you guys are so busy, it's not even worth it? Or is it worth reaching out? How does a kid break in?
Well, I have like one thing, not us specifically or whatever, but I can tell you what not to do. Don't contact me and say, can we get together and have a coffee?
I
can get coffee.
Did I do that to you? I feel like I maybe did that to you like 10 years
everybody
ago.
Knows, everybody knows why somebody's wrong.
You know?
Yeah, right.
One way to do it is that actually a traditional way of doing it, whether you're an orchestra player or whether you're a trumpet player that was doing like sessions in the 80s or whatever, is to study with that person. Get together with them, or even if you want to talk to them sit down, you know, have one lesson or two lessons, just tell me everything you know, want to tell me about like subbing, you know, to sub or to study with that person so they get to know you and then they'll say, oh yeah, let me
you can do this,
this guy or recommend that guy or something like that. I don't know. Do you have
It's all available now. Peter knows this from, you know, starting out with subbing a few years ago. When was your first show?
2017.
So not that long ago.
Right.
But now, like, BroadwayMusicians.com lists every show.
Isn't that the best
and every
site?
It's player.
All right there. Yeah.
And then, of course, you've still got to find out how to get in touch with that player. So, you can cold contact people. But as John said, if you've never done a show before, you know, that's not good. And if they don't know you, and okay, you can send them, here's some links to me playing and stuff like that. Yeah. And, you know, will they look at it? Maybe not.
Everyone sounds good.
But
I think don't underestimate, though, the power of doing something else. Right. Like we had been playing in that Greek band for like 3 years before we ever had a conversation about, you know, and then so by the time I was making out, you know, my cold calls, for example, I also had my reel for things that I was doing. And there were people in the scene, you know, Richard Hammond was a bass player on that gig for a while. And, you know, so by the
time. You weren't a total stranger to the scene.
Right. There was like at least like one degree of proximity to the scene. It wasn't a totally random cold call like, hey, I play nylon string. Can I do your thing? Like, you know, there was at least like I had been already working on something and demonstrated a skill set that people in the scene recognized. And so, you know, it's like when you send a job, you know, a resume for a traditional job, you know, somebody's going to see where you worked and they might know somebody that worked there and they'll call them without telling you that they're going to call it. Like, hey, like, who is this guy? You know, that might be a thing that happens.
Word of mouth and recommendation from people is still a big thing. You know,
that's
for
it.
Sure.
That's
for
sure. It. The Broadway Roundtable right here. These guys are the busiest guys in New York, playing on shows that everyone knows and has heard of. Guys, thank you for coming in.
All right, Zach.
For coming on to the show.
Thanks, Zach.
Appreciate
Thanks
it.
For watching. If you've made it this far into the episode and if you still don't know how to sub on a show, I got nothing else for you. We did it. Thank you guys for coming in. We'll see you next time. Thanks for watching.
All right, great.
Thanks.
Thank you, guys.